Your happiness and your success at work is really influenced and dependent on the quality of your working relationships. And yet, most of us just cross our fingers and we hope for the best rather than actually doing anything about it. So the goal is to build the best possible relationship with your key working people. And most of us don't. It feels a bit counterintuitive to look the other person in the eye and go, hey, before we get cracking on this, what if you and I talk about how we work together in the best possible way so we can do the best possible work that's in front of us?
Welcome to Evolve Leadership, the arena where high-achieving leaders are challenged to redefine their limits. My name is Angus Nelson. I grew up in the United States and I now live in Lisbon, Portugal. I'm an executive coach and I've spent my career advising and training leaders from startups to Fortune 500 companies. And here's what I've learned. An old, ineffective leadership framework will always keep you on a hamster wheel, consumed with work-life balance, burnout, and stress. Here on the show, each week we'll help you rethink the path to achievement. We'll help you discover new principles, new philosophies to the modern leader. Look, the world is relentlessly changing, demanding a new era of leaders. It's time to redefine your limits. So enter the arena, my friend. It's time to evolve. Welcome to the Evolve Leader Show. I'm your host, Angus Nelson. Today we are talking to someone who's been here before. This is one of the few people who have been a return guest. He wrote a book called The Coaching Habit. It sold over a million copies some years ago, and he's back with us with his new book, and it's all about how to get along with almost anyone. Super smart. He's like a Rhodes Scholar. Let's jump into that interview right now. Well, welcome to the show, Mr. Michael Bungay Stanier, aka MBS. Great to see you again.
Angus, thank you for having me back. First of all, Angus is one of my favorite names because I have a brother called Angus, so that we call him Gus. And so like anybody who's called Angus, who invites me onto anything, I'm almost certainly going to say yes, but it's great to be back after what, 8 years or close to it.
Yeah, it's been a while. It has been a while. And you've been putting out a number of books. I have another one here. We didn't get to interview you on the advice trap, but, I dig that one up just so I could show it to you on the screen and say, look, I have your shit.
That's good. I have a fragile male ego. So having people hold my stuff up and say, I've got your book actually makes me feel pretty good. So thank you for that.
Well, perfect. My pleasure. And I want to jump into this real quick because one of the things that I even told you right before we got this call is self-awareness is something that people struggle with. And the context of your newest book is, you know, how to work with almost anyone. I love that almost in there.
It's good, isn't it? It's a good twist on the title.
Oh, for sure. And there's an aspect of like, you have to like be A, committed, B, I think patient, and then C, the self-awareness, which I think is a critical component. But I want to dive in first for those who haven't read the book before we like nerd out on some of this stuff. Can you give us like a 30,000 feet flyby?
Sure.
The keystone conversations and the
totally
the related the best relationship, all that
BPR, the best possible relationship. Yeah. So, here it is in a single breath, or maybe two breaths. Your happiness and your success at work is really influenced and dependent on the quality of your working relationships. And yet, most of us just cross our fingers and we hope for the best, rather than actually doing anything about it. So the goal is to build BPRs, the best possible relationship with your key working people, whether that's your boss or whether it's your team or whether it's a person giving you money or a supplier or a vendor or a customer, whoever it is. When you think of the key people, how do you build the best possible relationship with them? Not a perfect relationship, but the best expression of a working relationship that is safe and vital and repairable. The three pillars: safe, emotional safety, vital. I think of it as psychological bravery, a willingness to push and challenge and grow and learn and expand and kind of take some risk. And repairable, meaning we get to fix it when it goes wrong, because it always goes wrong. It always goes off the rails to some degree. And the key tactic behind building a BPR, a best possible relationship, is the keystone conversation, which is simply this. Have a conversation about how you work together before you plunge into the work itself. And most of us don't. Most of us just, there's so much work. It's there. It's urgent. It's important. It's calling us. We've done nothing but work all our lives. It feels a bit counterintuitive to look the other person in the eye and go, hey, before we get cracking on this, what if you and I talk about how we work together in the best possible way so we can do the best possible work that's in front of us?
I love it. And that's where I want to start, that conversation, because that's obviously you have to be vulnerable. You have to be transparent. It's going to take a little confidence, a little courage. How does someone basically confront or be able to stimulate that conversation? What's the appropriate way to approach someone in a way that they would receive it?
Yeah. So I'm going to refine your language, which is like, you have to be vulnerable-ish. You have to be transparent-ish. This isn't a plunge into a therapist's couch where you're like, you have to reveal all and talk about childhood trauma and weep or whatever. It depends very much on the person with whom you're having the conversation with about how best to set this up. Mm-hmm. So if you're leading a team, you may just make it as part of your practice for onboarding the people on your team and quarterly or even a 6-monthly check-in going, hey, how are we doing? How are you and I working together? And is there anything we need to do to refine that so you're happier and more effective and I'm happier and more effective? Mm-hmm. Sometimes with a vendor, like when I'm just in the middle of hiring somebody to rebuild my website. And I'm like, okay, so, you know, we're having this first kind of kickoff conversation. And I'm like, okay, so when you've worked with somebody like me before, a client, and it's been a really good client relationship, what happened? What did they do? What did you do? What was the magic? And when you worked with a client like me before, and it kind of sucked, because I bet you've had those, what happened? Why did it suck? What did you do? What did they do? And now I said, and now let me tell you my experience with vendors, people building websites for me, because I've had some I loved and some I've hated. I'm going to tell you what made me love it and what made me hate it. Mm-hmm. So I just threw that into the conversation. Now, to be fair, Angus, the person I was talking to did have a slightly wide-eyed look to them. Like, nobody's ever asked me that before. But I didn't. But they did fine and I did fine. And part of the power is that we've now given each other permission to keep talking about the working relationship. So it depends. Like if you're your boss, if you're like, I want to have this conversation with my boss and that's scary and hard and I'm not sure if she's going to be up for it, you might go, well, what's the safest thing I could do? What's the simplest conversation I could have? You go, like, hey, could I have a chat about how we're working together? I'd like to understand what you're looking for in a really good working relationship from one of your direct reports so I can do that. Mm-hmm. And if I'm a boss, I'm like, I love people who ask me that. Maybe ask me that. Then I like you more and I trust you more because you've actually signaled to me that you're up for not just working, but actually, how do I work smartly with the person who determines my future in some ways?
You said in the book that when you ask the question, it's a question you also have to be willing to answer.
I think so.
And that's the exchange. And it's almost like a handshake agreement.
Right.
So when someone goes to ask those questions, how do they like ask the right question?
Yeah. So handshake agreement is a really perceptive comment, Angus, because, you know, the origin for this work for me comes from the work of Peter Block, who, you know, he wrote a book, I don't know, 40 years ago called The Flawless Consultant, which I love. And he has championed for years this idea of building, I would, in my words, adult to adult working relationships. And he taught me something called social contracting, which is basically what I'm teaching here, which is like, how do we, let's set up a contract between us around how we work well together. Now, I don't love the phrase social contract because it's a bit abstract and a bit philosophical and a bit kind of confusing. But there's something very perceptive about it being a contract, because a contract is an equal exchange of value. That's what it is in, under law. And same with a handshake agreement. That's kind of a verbal contract, a verbal agreement. So in the book, I've got 5 questions that I think you can ask and answer And you can ask and answer all of them, or you could pick and choose the ones that feel most useful for you. Or quite frankly, Angus, you can make up your own. Like if you've got better questions around, you know, a conversation around how we work together, ask those. But if you ask it, it's also helpful to answer it, because that is part of the exchange of trust and vulnerability and openness and a sense of we're co-creating a good working relationship together.
You also said, and this kind of goes back to, I guess this would be two books ago when we talked, and you reflected on when we have these conversations, one of the most powerful things you can do is to stay curious longer, like probe in, ask questions, be interested. And I think this works great in conflict too. Instead of like reacting, you can like be curious just because your impulse probably is inaccurate and you're working off of all sorts of emotional impulses, bad storylines for your past, blah, blah, blah. So one was to stay curious longer. And the other one was to, be slower at giving advice.
Exactly. You got it. So, the book I'm best known for, which we talked about, is The Coaching Habit. And that is the essential behavior change that I'm trying to encourage with that book, which is like, can you stay curious a little bit longer? Can you rush to action and advice giving a little bit more slowly? You don't have to stay curious forever. You don't have to, you know, never give advice, because that's ridiculous. But this place of curiosity is extraordinarily powerful, because when you're being curious, for the most part, you're not being sucked into a dysfunctional dynamic. Now, let me do a tiny bit of teaching around this, because this actually comes from the Coaching Habit book, but it's one of my favorite models. It's called the Cartman Drama Triangle. And the Cartman Drama Triangle says, look, when things get dysfunctional, they always do, three different roles play out. There's the victim, there's the persecutor, and there's the rescuer. Now, what I love about this, because somebody once said, all models are wrong, but some are useful. So I think this is a wrong but useful model, is that you kind of intuitively get it, right? So victim, oh, I know what people playing the victim role looks like. I know what me playing the victim role looks like. Persecutor, oh, I totally get what somebody playing that role looks like. I know what I'm like when I'm in that role as well. And rescuer, which sounds a bit better than the other two, but it's just as dysfunctional as the other two. That I know what that looks like, jumping in, saving it, fixing it, being the person who like makes it, it okay for everybody else. And they're all dysfunctional and they're all reactive. They're all like you just kind of react and you do that and things go downhill. You know, when you're in the drama triangle, this is not the best version of you showing up. And curiosity is one of the most powerful things to pull you out of the drama triangle and actually help you to say, look, we've got a shared thing we're trying to figure out here. Me asking some better questions can help us figure out what's at the heart of the challenge that we're facing, whether that's a work challenge or whether that's a you and me challenge.
The entrepreneurs that I work with, one of the things that is the most challenging is their people. Full stop. You know, working with people, and part of that is also
It's annoying because work happens through people. You're like,
so counter.
You know, who hasn't had that moment where you're like, this would be so much easier if I just didn't have people as part of this work? Yeah. And you also know that even with AI and ChatGPT, you need people.
Yeah.
So you've got to figure out how to work best with people for your sake and for their sake.
Hence why we are talking today.
Exactly.
Right. So in that same context, it's like when entrepreneurs have to have conversations. Number one, they're under a lot of pressure. Just, you know, they, especially if you're an owner, like you're carrying the weight of things that others just they have no concept. Payroll, expectations, investors, blah, blah, blah. And now here comes Johnny, here comes Sally, and they're coming with their issues or whatever. And, you know, you have to navigate with such poise and you have to like change gears. One of the things that I loved about your book was to look at, it was we judge, you said this, you said, we judge ourselves by our intentions, we judge others by their actions. So in that moment, when, you know, the owner, the founder, whatever is under pressure, how do they switch gears?
Now, to be clear, I can't take the credit for that insight about we judge ourselves by our intentions and others by their kind of actual behaviors. But it's powerful, isn't it? It's like when we screw up, you're like, yeah, I screwed up, but I've got a good heart. I've got a good intention. There were extenuating circumstances. When other people screw up, they're like, see, that just confirms that I've hired a loser and I'm quite disappointed about this.
Yeah.
So just knowing that is off to a good start.
Mm.
I think knowing that work happens through people. So you're like, so look, my job is to bring out the best in that person so they can best serve the mission of the company that I've started. Like the twin DNA of organizational success is strategy and culture. And of course, everybody's heard that. Those words get bandied around all the time. But, you know, they're DNA. They entwine each other. They support each other. One doesn't make any sense without the other. And so with strategy, you're basically going, what's the most important work for us to do? And that's part of why coaching is so powerful, not just at a personal level, but at a strategic level. Because one of the essential questions in coaching is, what's the real challenge here for you? Let's get to the most important thing, the hardest thing, the thing that we've got to crack to figure that out. That's in some ways a kind of day-to-day experience of what focusing on the strategy is. And then the culture is like, how do I keep and grow and enhance and encourage and shape my very best people so I've got the best people doing the work that matters? And part of it is like, even as a founder, when you've got all the fires burning, you're like, you've got to spend that time to go, how do I bring the best to my people? And of course, what I'm trying to do, Angus, in the books that I write and in the stuff that I teach, is let me make this unweird for you and let me make this as fast as possible for you. It's not instant, but this doesn't have to take forever. You know, coaching doesn't have to involve a 1-hour conversation with them lying on a therapist bed and you going, oh, I know, it sounds so hard. It's about going, how do I help you learn and grow, be courageous and be brave and do the stuff that matters and hear the feedback you need to hear? Because if I've built your competence and your confidence and your autonomy and your self-sufficiency, then I win. Mm-hmm. Because you're the best person possible for working on the stuff that matters to me as the founder.
And it's so interesting because some fragile egos get threatened by employees who are smarter, who are younger, who are, you know, craftier, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And yet the clients that I've had or people that I've worked with that relish that, love to be around people that are smarter than them, love to build a team with people who might even be younger than them. Like, those are the people who typically excel because they have this quotient where they can understand that their role is to make those other people better, is to guide those people and motivate them in a way that they can be successful.
So Angus, how do you help people make that shift? Because that is a fundamental, foundational awareness, and it takes a degree of courage. I mean, honestly, when you get old, like Angus and I are old, it's like it's actually impossible to hire anybody who isn't younger than you these days. It's just the way it is. And for me anyway, smarter than true as well. But how do you support your founders and entrepreneurs to be courageous like that?
It always starts inward, right? Is the first thing is courageous with self.
Mm.
And like our whole program basically is kind of a Roto-Rooter in the first 3-4 weeks of helping them see kind of like a mirror reflected, you know, like,
right.
Like it's like going to lunch and then that evening you get home and you're like talking to your spouse and your spouse says, hey, you've got that broccoli in your teeth. Where you got something in your teeth. And like, that's been there all day, but nobody told me.
Right.
That's our role. Is our role is to be the mirror to show you the broccoli that's in your teeth. And then secondarily is to, from that place, move you to a place of strength that when you have these faults, when you have these failures, when you have these challenges, like all of those are shaping you and that life is basically preparing you for what life has prepared for you. So therefore, you've never missed an opportunity. You've never failed that you can't get up. You've never missed out on something you can't get again.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it changes your belief system. So now when you get other people around you, that shit gets contagious.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really powerful. Although you gave me two metaphors, broccoli in the teeth and a Roto-Rooter. You know, I'm not totally sure what to do with that combination, but I'll go with it.
So I was actually going to ask you too, like the emphasis to these books, what was it where maybe you like fell down or where you messed up, where you have regret that maybe you could have handled this situation better?
Before we continue, I want to acknowledge something important. By listening to this show, you are taking a step that many leaders are frankly unwilling to do, and that is invest in yourself. And to honor your commitment, we want to invest in you. Our research shows that elite leaders excel in six core areas, and we've developed a quick 2-minute assessment to help you highlight your strengths, uncover your blind spots, and see how you stack up against other top leaders. You'll get a personalized report that pinpoints the areas you can address to evolve into that next level leader. So, to see where your leadership stands, go to rankmyleadership.com. Now, back to the show.
Well, certainly with how to work with almost anyone, there's a legion of working relationships that were less than they might have been. And, you know, I'm not even trying to pretend that all of my working relationships could have been, you know, marvelous and kind of, you know, unicorns bouncing around a paddock, burping up rainbows. Mm-hmm. You know, I think for most of us, our working relationships probably show up on a bell curve, and you've got a few up one end, which you're like, they're fantastic. I love it. Kind of click. You've got a few at the other end, which is like, man, these are hard. And we just don't click. And we kind of rub each other up the wrong way. And most are kind of somewhere in the middle, and they're okay, and they're good enough, and they're fine. And I think across that whole bell curve, I'm like, I probably could have done a better job with almost all of my working relationships to keep them, and this is the three pillars of a best possible relationship, safe and vital and repairable. You know, it's like, I had some working relationships where I'm like, they were safe, they were really safe, and they were a bit boring. Honestly, they were a bit too safe, it was a bit too nice. You know, I hold some of the responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. And I had some relationships which were a bit too vital. Like for me, vital is just, you know, psychological bravery. And I'm like, you know what? My relationship with one of my first bosses, Matt, like he was challenging and provocative and edgy and the like. And sometimes that was amazing. And there are times where he just went too far and I got hurt and diminished as part of that experience. So we didn't arrive the right balance between safe and vital. And there's also a number of relationships where I'm like, I could have fixed that. That's the repairable side of it. It's like, I could have been the person who tried to build the bridge back to make it better than it was. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I've had my fair share of working relationships where I'm like, that just broke. Yeah. And you know, that ended in tears and flames, whatever. Mm-hmm. But more to the point, I'm like, I had more of my working relationships where I'm like, that could have been 5 or 10 or 20% better. Mm-hmm. And if it had been, that would have been a more joyful experience for me. I'd have made more of a difference. It would have been a better expression of who I am in the work that I do.
On the other side of this equation, it was so cool to have both a printed version, and then I downloaded the audio version.
Oh, cool.
And so the last 2 days, I walked around the park and walked my dogs, and I was listening. And then today, on my way to the gym, I finished it. And in between each chapter, we get to hear stories of people that shared some of the relationships that they had admired or had developed, you know, in their own careers. For you, in kind of like the reason why we do what we do, is there like a couple of wins that you have had people, readers, or maybe former employees that have taken and grasped some of these things that you've taught and just excelled in ways that are dreamy for an author, for sure?
That's a good question. I mean, there's a few people who come to mind. I mean, The most obvious one for me is Shannon, who is the CEO of a company I started called Box of Crayons. So Box of Crayons teaches organizations how to bring coaching skills to their managers and their leaders, how to help people stay curious a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with her for 7 years now, and she's been the CEO for 4 of them. Mm-hmm. And actually what's fantastic about, well, there's many things fantastic about her, but I hired her from behind the bar of my local pizzeria. This is the first real job she ever had. Yeah. She was doing a PhD in literature. I happen to have done a master's degree in literature. My wife
is a Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sitting behind, we're at the pizza bar and we're talking to her, and I'm like, man, you're really interesting. I like you. And we kind of geeked out about books and stuff. And she was doing a classic, you know, I'm being a TA, teacher's assistant. I'm working part-time in a publishing company. I'm working behind a bar. She's doing all this kind of hustle to try and make money to put her through graduate school. Mm-hmm. And the publishing company went bust. Mm-hmm. She was like, I'm bummed out about that. And I was like, well, why don't you come and help me market this new book I'm writing, The Coaching Habit? Mm-hmm. And she started off, and she was just so good that she just accelerated. I kept giving her more responsibility until finally I went, why don't you be the CEO? Because I think you'd be great at it. And she is great at it. Mm-hmm. And she has reinvented her senior team over the last 2 years. You know, at a certain point, she's like, you know, I'm feeling stuck because I'm feeling like I'm doing all the leading. I don't have a team of people around me who share that burden and share that responsibility and understand kind of classic, you know, the work you do, Angus, which is like, what does it mean to really be an entrepreneur, to be the person who is worrying about all the big picture stuff? Mm-hmm. You know, other people worry about their stuff, but they're like, here's what I see. It's like a smaller box. Mm-hmm. And a CEO or a founder or an entrepreneur has to kind of like, I'm thinking about all of it all the time.
Yeah.
And she has rebooted her working relationship. Some of it is letting people go. Some of it is hiring new people. Mm-hmm. But there are two people in her leadership team where she's like, we've restructured and reinvented that working relationship by doing some of the tools that I write about and teach, where I'm like, that's amazing. And so you can tell I have a little kind of glow of pride around that.
Especially coming from a company that you were able to like pass it on, like pass the baton. Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
So when we have this state of understanding that transition from you stepping out of running the business, I'm leaving your book for a second.
Yeah.
How did you know it was time for you to take a different role in your company?
You know, I had a coach, more of a friend at that stage, and they just noticed or helped me notice that, to put it bluntly, I kind of am a pretty mediocre CEO. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, you know, I'm a classic startup, you know, early facing. I'm like, I'm good with ideas. I'm good at books. I'm good at kind of making things feel accessible to people. But the discipline and the structure and the focus to run a company, I'm okay at it. Mm-hmm. On my good days. Yeah. On my bad days, I'm like I'm a walking disaster.
Yeah.
And I kind of get by on kind of chutzpah and, you know, a tiny bit of charisma and the patriarchy, because I'm like a straight white tall dude. So I've got a few things that are in my favor, but they're structural. Mm-hmm. There's nothing inherent in me that makes me a good CEO. So that was part of the awareness, which is like, I'm not that good at it. And also, I just don't love it. I mean, I was feeling tapped by the role rather than enlivened by it. And the thing that made the difference for us, Angus, is we hired somebody for 2 years, to a year leading up to Shannon taking on the role and a year post her becoming the CEO, mm-hmm. to be our transition person, mm-hmm. a transition coach, consultant, guide. And, you know, the year leading up to it was spent reassuring that Shannon, that she could do this job, because she's like, what is the job? Yeah. what do you do as CEO? And I'm like, I don't totally know. And by the way, whatever I do know, I don't want to tell you because I'm not that good at it.
Yeah.
And a good deal of it was spent setting up systems and structures that would stop me as the founder coming back to meddle. Yeah, because most founders get to a point where they're like, they're desperate to give up about 92% of the job and desperate to hold on to 8% of the job, where they like to stick their fingers in and kind of meddle and stuff.
Yeah.
So we set up some really clear structures that were like, these are the decisions I'm allowed to make. These are the decisions that Shannon talks to me before she makes. These are the decisions that Shannon makes without me needing to know about them. Mm-hmm. And that was the primary structure that enabled me to. Well, no, there are two other things. The two other things that really helped were we agreed that what was happening was Shannon was running her company. She wasn't managing my company. Mm-hmm. And the second thing was that I set up a thing called a new little company called MBS.Works, which didn't really have a thing to it other than be the sandpit in which I got to play so that I had something to distract me and wouldn't come back to Box of Crayons to try and, you know, muck it around. And those three things made all the difference in terms of making that transition a success. Cause, you know, that's one of the things I'm most proud of is like having started a company and successfully walked away from being the CEO of that. So that now I talk to Shannon once a month and we have a quarterly board meeting, and that's my involvement in the company.
Yeah. And now it's like a legacy that you're able to pass on and let go, right? Where a lot of entrepreneurs, I think, really jack themselves up is that sense of control. And even when they're in the seat as the CEO, they still meddle and they become the bottleneck for the company. They create more chaos, which is even more important why, you know, the content of this book is to have those kinds of keystone conversations to see how you can support, you know, if you happen to be working for this boss, or you happen to be in a role where you can have influence with that boss, to say, hey, here's a different perspective.
That's right. Well, let me share the model more precisely that we used that was helpful for us. It comes from Susan Scott's book called Fierce Conversations, and it's a tree model. Basically, root, trunk, branch, twig. And so twig decisions are decisions I'll never hear about. You know, just never. Branch decisions are decisions I'll hear about perhaps, you know, like Shannon writes an update or we chat and it just comes up in conversation. Trunk decisions are the decisions where she will come and talk to me about stuff. And for us, it was like hiring senior people and redoing the values and kind of capital investments over a certain amount. And then root decisions were the decisions that I got to make. And for us, I mean, it's different for every founder and, you know, new CEO. But actually, we got clear that for us, I only have two decisions with Box of Crayons: to fire Shannon or not, and to sell the company. That's it. When Shannon does things like, as she did in her first year, which is like, we're going to reboot the values of the company, vaguely traumatizing for me.
Hurt your feelings.
Yeah, exactly, which is a better way of putting it, which is like, yeah, but these are, I mean, of course, for founders, it's like, these are values, but actually they're like, this is just me.
Yeah.
This is me projecting my stuff and pretending that it's a universal value.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, but I'm like, but thank you for telling me, and it's not my company, it's your company, so these don't work for you anymore. And that, I mean, and she didn't scrap them entirely. She like kept four or kept three, tweaked one, abandoned one, you know, something like that.
You even have count of them, which is so great.
Yeah. So, but that, if we hadn't got that discipline around what decisions I get to make, there's no doubt that I'd have gone, yeah, sure, reboot the values, but I'd like to just sign off on them before you do. Right. And I don't get that because that's not our agreement.
Yeah. You said in the book, be the strongest signal. And your energy then is contagious, right? Basically, Shannon was in this place of being the strongest signal now.
That's right.
So that now her energy, her ethos now has a fingerprint, you know, amongst the culture.
And my gravity is diminished because, you know, as soon as I show up, I warp time and space in that company because I'm the guy who wrote the book. I'm the founder. I'm the this, I'm the that. It is impossible for me not to distort things. So we're trying to reduce my gravity and increase hers for the sake of the company, but also just for Shannon and kind of her ability to grow into the role.
I love this. Okay, I got one more question for you, and we'll bring this in for a landing. The books, the heart, the words, the time you put into this, like if you could flash forward 5-10 years from now, what's the big dream? What's the impact and the transformation you want to make in the world?
I've had a phrase that I've had for close to 20 years now that helps me decide what projects I say yes to. Like kind of work on a project by project basis. You know, I finish a book and I'm like, so what's the next thing I could create that would be cool? And the mission as I see it for myself is to infect 1 billion people with the possibility virus. Now, this did sound better before COVID, and people are less excited about being infected by viruses now. But you know, it made sense at the time, because the possibility virus for me, it's similar to kind of man's search for meaning. That inside that, in any situation, you have choice. What are the choices you're making? How do you make the braver choice? You know, Viktor Frankl wrote that in whilst being a prisoner in a prisoner of war camp. So it's this idea of like, I can't teach people. The best outcome for me would be for people to say, I'm at choice rather than reactive, and I made the braver choice. And the possibility virus for me is infecting people with it means I'm trying to create things that spread without me being at the center of it, without me having to be the teacher or the guru or the star or the author. You know, for me, if this content spreads and people end up having Keystone conversations and they don't know why it's called a Keystone conversation, or they're asking, so what's the real challenge here for you and what else? And they don't really know, you know, that combination of questions that I came up with. I mean, that's a win for me. It's not a great business model sometimes, but it's a bigger win for me, which is like, I'm trying to shift behavior a little bit. And so with my projects, I'm like, this is the best idea I've got for my next project. This is my best idea for trying to bring it into the world and trying to set it alight and get a virtuous circle spinning. And then my next job is to go, well, what's the next cool thing that I might create that could be helpful for people? Exactly.
That's one of his questions.
Exactly. But if I can do some of that, I mean, 1 billion people, I'm like, you know, that's an impossible number. And I can't even measure it. I don't know how I would measure it. But it sets a kind of a hunger and aspiration and a scale at which I want to play that makes me braver than I might otherwise be.
10x is easier than 2x right there. Dan Sullivan all the priorities change.
I've read that book, and honestly, I didn't like it much as a book, but I love the title of it.
Yeah. The audio version's great. Kind of like yours, in between each chapter, they riff and then they unpack all the stuff, which is pretty cool.
The experience of reading the book was basically just having somebody shouting at me, 10X is better than 2X the whole time. And I'm like, I got that already from the title. But, you know, this year, for instance, inspired by that book, we've set a 10-year goal to sell 10 million copies of my books over the next 10 years, because that's a 10x goal for us, because we've sold kind of north of 1 million copies of my books. And I'm like, man, that's really impossible. And I can't but help think more strategically and more precisely and more courageously, kind of setting that bigger goal.
So that's twice you've said impossible. The 1 billion is impossible, and then doing this, you know, 10 million would be impossible. And yet your dream is possibility. So we're going to change your language into the possibility. But
I don't want you to change my language, because I'm not put off by impossible. Like I've got, on my desk over there, I've got a quote from the poet Rilke, which, and he wrote a poem called The Man Watching. And I'll get the line slightly wrong, but he says his goal is not to win. but to be deeply defeated by ever greater things. So I'm looking to be deeply defeated by ever greater things. So I'm really comfortable with me going, these are impossible.
Yeah.
And that's not daunting for me. That's actually fuel for me.
That was moving right there. That's a great quote. I like to say permission is one of the biggest things that people struggle for themselves. Is even to give themselves permission that something is possible, even to give themselves permission to get out of their own way, give themselves permission to believe something they otherwise wouldn't believe. So as we bring this in for a landing, there's one little segment out of your book that I want to leave all of our listeners with, whether you're in your car, whether you are mowing the lawn, whether you are just got done confronting your children and throwing things at each other. It's this, that you stay open-minded, open-handed, and open-hearted. And it's a way the world and work can be very, very different. Thanks so much, Michael, for being a part of the show today.
Thank you, Ennis. That was wonderful.
As we wrap up another episode of Evolve Leadership, thank you so much for taking time to invest in you. If there's to be any sustainable growth in your company or even in your relationships, you must grow first. And it's what I love to do for leaders, to help them grow, to challenge their thinking, sharpen self-awareness, to instill an unshakable confidence, and ultimately upgrade their sense of self. And we do this through our proprietary method called Agile EQ Plus, where we're leveraging agile leadership and emotional intelligence. We provide our signature training for individuals, and for businesses, we've designed a unique curriculum for company-wide learning and development. If you'd like to learn more about our training or to schedule a call, you can simply go to evolveleadership.org. And until next time, stay driven, keep climbing, and never stop evolving.